The big ship was rigged for solo sailing. In a matter of minutes, without any help from Ryan, Tom had the sheets up and full of wind, and they were skimming due south, away from Port Aville. When the captain ducked down to shut off the diesel, he waved for the others to come up top. Mildred took a seat on the cockpit's built-in bench.
You've got a few bullet holes through the hull, but they're all above the waterline.
And there's nothing to worry about. I'll check them after we get some distance from here.
Isn't Boom T going to send ships to chase us?
Maybe in another life.
You took him out?
Not me.
Tom nodded toward Ryan, who shrugged.
It was either that or keep looking over our shoulders for the rest of our days. Boom T wasn't the forgiving kind, and we did pretty much wipe out his livelihood.
Pretty much? All we left him with was his bedspread.
Yeah, and they can fish it out of the bay and bury him in it.
JB cradled his sore ribs with a forearm, glancing back over the water.
All things considered, we didn't come out of this too bad.
No, we didn't. Tom, that's JB. Here's Christy and Mildred, Doc Tanner and Jack. I'm Ryan Carter.
Good to know you.
What's your last name, Tom?
Wolf.
And your ship's called Tempest?
Wait a red blasted minute. You're the Harmonica Tom?
The who? The what?
Half the stuff you've heard is bull, JB.
Well, I heard you single-handedly repelled a boarding party off the Linus. Then you trolled a wounded Coldheart in your boat wake. Robert's crew regrouped and tried to rescue him in their own ship. You kept their men just out of their reach for better than a mile, until something triple big and triple nasty swam up from below and cut him clean in two. You played a jig on your mouth organ the whole time, and that's how you got the nickname.
Well, that one's true. But hey, I knew who you were the minute I set eyes on you, Carter. No mistaking that missing peeper and scar. Know some of what you've done, too. Funny how quick word gets round who's chilled who. You took down Baron Willie Elijah and Baron Tormo. And you nailed that oversexed pile of pus, Captain Piraquat, with a spear.
Harpoon, actually.
Well, if it was long and pointy, old Pira probably died happy.
Not particularly.
You can bet the news about today's little shindig will spread along the coast like wildfire. Boom T was widely known, but not widely admired. Traitor might have set the benchmark for fucking with people's shit at Virtue Lake, but what you just did at Port Aville runs a close second.
Boom T did it to himself.
And that's what folks are going to be talking about for years to come. How you all set him up for a royal hosing, and how DP swallowed the stink bait.
Anyway, how long is this trip to offload the C4 going to take?
The distance is 240 miles, plus or minus. How long it actually takes is up to the wind and the tide. We could do it in less than a day if we're lucky. That means sailing all night, of course. Which means round-the-clock watches. Got plenty of hands for that, so we can all get some shut-eye. Round-the-clock watch is something we have to do anyway because of the competition.
Who's the competition?
Pickings aren't what they used to be. Scroungers are having to dig deeper and deeper into the nuked-out places for spoils. The prime, top-quality goods are a hell of a lot harder to come by than they were even 5 years ago. You saw the god-awful garbage Boom T was selling. Gotta figure that the decline in merchandise is something that's only gonna get worse as time goes on. After all, they aren't making any new stockpiles. Long and short of it, some of my seafaring brothers and sisters are stockpiling cargoes offshore by bushwhacking and raiding other traders. Seems like there's always a boat or two patrolling, looking for an easy hijack. The unlucky traders and crews just disappear, and their ships sail into port with fresh faces. Goes without saying that nobody asked where the goods came from or where the previous owners went.
They've turned pirate.
Traders, pirates. It's always been hard to tell the two apart.
And it's gotten even harder of late. Believe me, it's not like it used to be in these parts when there was plenty of the good stuff to go around. I don't suppose you've heard any tales about what's happening well to the south of here, down the Atlantic coast?
What tales?
Yeah, I didn't think you had. The stories have filtered up as far as Padre Island, but the traders working out of there have kept a lid on them. Nobody wants to start a stampede of newcomers. There's too many in the business as it is. The details are sketchy, as you would expect, but it sounds like the folks to the south came out of the apocalypse better than we did up here. They didn't get any direct missile hits. Nuke winter wasn't near as hard for them as it was for us. They caught some badass tidal waves, though. I've heard rumors they're still making diesel in the pre-dark plants. Other shit, too. You know, manufacturing stuff like before Skydark. I was thinking seriously about sailing down there myself just to see what's what. If things are opening up half that good, I wouldn't mind getting in on the ground floor.
How far?
Mex and Point South.
We've been to Mex City.
And?
It was just another shit heap. Not a nuked shit heap, though. It was shaken apart by earthquakes and volcanoes blowing off their tops. Natives weren't all that friendly, either. It wasn't much different than here, except for the funny hats.
How'd you manage to get all the way to Mex City?
On foot.
Ryan lied without batting an eye. The pre-dark Matran system that allowed the companions to jump between redoubts in seconds was too valuable a secret to give away.
Sailing's a hell of a lot easier than walking, and there's more to the world than what any of us has seen. There's gotta be.
In terms of total landmass and population before Skydark, that's a no-brainer. What's left, of course, is anybody's guess.
It has been said that travel broadens one. Of course, it can also get you beheaded.
So then, travel makes you shorter?
Jack made a joke. What's the nuking world coming to?
Well, we all gotta die some way. Might as well be some way interesting. And a person has gotta look farther ahead than just the next meal or the next safe hole to crawl into at night. Gotta look past what's here now to set a course. A proper course.
Tom paused and gazed off to starboard, frowning as he seemed to consider something important.
I got a business proposition for you folks. I've been thinking about it for a good long time. I don't make the proposition lightly, and this is the first I've mentioned it to anyone. We know each other by reputation, and I've seen what you can do, the kind of fight you put up with my own eyes. The business proposition requires a sec crew. A heavy-duty sec crew I can trust to sail down the Atlantic coast with me, maybe all the way to Tierra del Fuego if need be. I figure you're just what I've been looking for. Got no back down in you. We can supply Tempest from the Padre Island stockpiles and head on south. We'll share the spoils of the trip equal shares. No telling the wonders and riches we might find.
A journey of discovery. A reprise of the Lewis and Clark expedition, 300 years after the fact.
I don't have a clue what you're rattling on about, Doc. Or you either, Tom. You're talking about making an open-ended sea voyage through unknown waters based on gaudy house gossip?
No risk, no gain.
We're not shy about taking risks, and big ones at that. But the gain at the far end has to be more than a pipe dream.
Hey, correct me if I'm wrong, but when you sashayed into Port Ayville, your butts were dragging mighty low, tongues half hanging out. For adventurers, you ain't exactly living high on the hog, are you? You're barely scraping by. My guess is, more often than not, you're hungry, thirsty, cold, and low on ammo. At a point not too far down the line, all the Hellscape's prime booty will be gone, and there'll be no more scraping by the way you've done. No survival except for those who don't mind stump-clearing, rock-chucking, and shit-shoveling. I'm talking fighting off muties with wooden clubs and with blasters made out of iron pipe and baling wire, and you all know I'm right. You can read the signs as well as I can. The awful day when the pre-dark spoils run out is coming, as sure as hell smells like sulfur. Nothing can stop it. Don't say no to my idea right off. Think on it a while. That's all I'm asking.
We'll think on it.
Plenty of food and drink in the galley. Go down and help yourselves.
Ryan was the last to descend the steep companionway. He could stand in the rear cabin without bumping the top of his head, but barely. On the port side was an aft bunk. In the middle of the cabin stood a chart table. An open, locked-back bulkhead door led into the main salon. On the right was the galley. Propane cooktop, sink, counter. Hanging above the sink in a net were pots, pans, and cooking utensils. On the left was a dinette table surrounded on three sides by a settee. Above the back cushions were two rows of densely packed bookshelves. The table was set with miscellaneous bowls, jars, jugs, and bags of food. Forward, through another locked-open bulkhead door, Ryan could see another set of steps, and beyond them, V-berths at the bow of the ship. He assumed that Tempest's cargo holds were hidden below decks. The cabin was scuffed and chipped, but spanking clean. There was a faint smell of bleach. The companion slid in around the small table, and without fanfare, plowed directly into the eats and drinks. There was salted hardtack for bread, shelled walnuts, ripe tomatoes bigger than Ryan's fist, melons, oranges, a variety of dried fruits, and plenty of fresh water. The jars held pickled hard-boiled eggs and fillets of small fish. They packed it in like there was no tomorrow, filling the voids. Jack licked every drop of tomato juice that dripped down his snow-white wrist.
Not bad grub.
Christy held up a piece of pickled fish on a knife point for Mildred to sniff.
Oh, this is just nasty.
Ah, that's foul. Don't eat that.
Christy plopped the tidbit back into the jar and screwed the lid down tight. Their hunger at last sated, the companions pushed back against the settee's cushions and finally relaxed. Mildred glanced at the others.
Do we have to think twice about this offer? It's our first real chance to see what the rest of the world is like. What do you think, JB?
Yeah, we saw Mex and we saw Baja. We saw other foreign lands. They were shit pits. Barely got out of some places in one piece, if you'll remember.
My dear John Barrymore, you know other nations have survived. Entire pre-dark nations, perhaps. Even cultures.
Ever wonder why these advanced civilizations haven't paid Deathlands a visit in the last 100 years? Or sent rescue missions?
Maybe because they think we're all chilled. Perhaps they think there's nothing left to visit or save. Nothing but poisoned earth, air, and water, and crazy muties. Maybe they've turned their backs on us for bringing on the end of the world. Any or all of those reasons could be valid.
Or they could be bullshit.
JB scowled, cradling his injured side. The pain of his injury seemed to have put him in a particularly foul temper.
Deep down, you and Doc still want everything to be back the way you remember it, before you got frozen and time-trawled, before the nuke cost. And that's not going to happen. The both of you are living in a dream world. You don't want to admit that what we have here is all there is. Maybe even better than what's left of the world. We've seen some downright evil shit in parts of the world we've visited.
We know what we're up against in the Deathlands. The four of us were born and bred here. We've come up fighting muties, cold hearts, and barons. We know how to survive whatever the hellscape throws at us. And we've got the Mattrans as our ace in the hole. We can always get out of a hot spot in a hurry if we have to. Where this tub is headed, there aren't going to be any redoubts. No Mattrans, no quick escapes, no telling what's going to be thrown at us. On this tub, if something goes wrong, we're dead meat.
Sailing south could be a suicide mission.
Arms folded across his chest, Jack nodded in assent.
In case you haven't noticed by now, life is a suicide mission.
Wait a minute. Let's just look at the facts in front of us. Harmonica Tom's the real deal. We know that. If he's done a quarter of the stuff people say he's done, there's no better skipper.
Okay, facts on the table. How long could the trip take?
If the historic voyages of discovery are any measure, perhaps a year, barring accident. Perhaps longer. The distance spanned round trip is something on the order of 12,000 miles.
Nuke in hell.
Assuming we found something valuable, how much of it could we bring back on this boat? 7 people and provisions for same are going to make it kind of cramped.
That depends on what the valuables are. Good things sometimes come in small packages.
There's more to this than just a fresh vein of booty. This could change all our lives for the better. If there's another world out there, an unnuked world, maybe we wouldn't want to come back.
Maybe you wouldn't want to come back.
If you've got big love in your heart for the Deathlands because you were born in it, that's your business. But from what I've seen over the years, I'd say all the hellscape does is kick our asses. But hey, maybe that's just me.
And what if the captain isn't telling us the whole truth? What if he's holding something important back to get us to sign on, figuring he'll break the bad news when it's too late for us to back out?
We kind of outnumber him.
A guy doesn't survive solo without having some neat tricks up his sleeve.
Ryan held up his hands, again trying to calm things down. Though he didn't show it, he was deeply concerned by the way things were shaking out. For the first time, he realized the possibility that a fork in the road might permanently split up his crew.
Look, I can see both sides of this. It isn't a matter of looking for new adventures. We've got plenty of that without shipping out. It's about the devil we know versus the devil we don't. The familiar, bad as it is still familiar. We can pretty much reckon how we're gonna die. Starvation, thirst, gutshot, backstabbed, ate by some mutie. I don't particularly care where I croak or how. But if there's a chance of never having to go hungry or drink my own piss again...
So you're for taking this pipe dream trip and maybe never coming back?
Are we going to put it to a vote or what? Everybody in favor, raise their hands.
By the three Kennedys, can we please set some ground rules before we proceed? Is this going to be a majority decision that we all agree in advance to abide with? Or does the vote have to be unanimous?
There's not going to be a rat-blasted vote. It's too soon to make up our minds about any of this. We don't have to decide until after we're paid for the C4. Let's wait and see how the Islander deal works out. Maybe pick up some more information while we're there. Get a better feel for how the captain does business and how he runs his ship.
Relief washed over Ryan as he saw his words sink in. Everyone sat back, their expressions thoughtful.
Of course, you're correct, Ryan. Your logic is impeccable. There is no need for haste in the matter, and a decision this important is best made by cool heads all around.
So we're going to wait and see?
Ryan pointedly stared down the companions in turn. Each of them nodded in agreement. To break the staring contest, Mildred shifted on the settee and ran her finger along the titles from the spines of the shelved books and magazines. There were century-old National Geographic magazines, sailing and travel books, books on first aid and emergency surgery, marine engine repair and gunsmithing books, cookbooks, crudely printed volumes on creating homemade explosives and poisons, and books that taught foreign languages, Spanish, French, German, Chinese, Japanese.
Our host has acquired quite a broad collection of useful 20th century nonfiction.
On the bottom shelf was a long section of dog-eared paperback pulp science fiction and fantasy novels. The gaudily jacketed Slaughter Realms books were sequentially numbered from 157 to 241 and filed in order of publication. JB pulled one out and opened it. He scanned a few random pages. The edges of the brittle yellowed paper crumbled at his touch.
Listen to this. Damn you, Ragnar. I'll soon cleave your fire-furred Norse wedding tackle from your groinal region. The Iroquois ninja princess hurriedly scythed her singing katana around and around her head, making her firm, upthrusting breasts jostle beneath her buckskin doublet ever more wildly with each rotation. Huff-da! The Viking leader responded with a guttural roar, ducking under the voracious windmilling attack to snatch up his Martian-made brain armor from the castle's basaltic flagstones. He clapped the filigreed silver metaplastic bowl down on his head, bending the tops of his huge pale ears against his scraggly red pigtails, thus anticipating and deflecting the cloud operative's flanking maneuver.
Christy put a hand on JB's wrist and gently forced him to lower the book.
Stop, please. It's making my head hurt.
Oh, it's funny. What else are we supposed to do?
We wait and see where this takes us.
Oki lay on his back in a vile puddle, hallucinating. Phantoms cloaked in black bunting swirled in and out of the edges of his field of vision. Ashen-faced phantoms with huge heads reveled, grimacing and grinding their long teeth. Their mirror-polished black boots shuffled and scraped on the floor's planking. Dust motes rose like smoke in the wedge of sunlight that burst through the hut's doorless doorway. It was the middle of the afternoon, the hottest part of the day. He couldn't get up. He was so weak he couldn't lift a hand to shoo away the flies drinking his tears and blood. It took all his strength just to suck the next breath. He lay slow baking in the hut oven, amid the reek of decomposition, shit, and piss. The bare mattress beneath him was soaked with all three. On the fourth day of the sickness, his terrible fever had abated, leaving him shaken and drained. He had thought that it was finally over. He was wrong. On the fifth day, the fever returned with a vengeance, and along with it, new and horrible symptoms. bleeding from gums, nose, and ass. Bright red spots had popped out all over his body. Bathed in cold sweat, his pulse rapid and thready, he had collapsed. That was yesterday. He hadn't moved since. He was not alone in the hut. His two wives lay on either side of him on their backs, dead. The babies in their protruding bellies, dead. Two of his six children had been taken to the Yokomaru because they had shown no sign of the illness. Everyone who had come down sick had been left in the vill, abandoned there to die. Oki's other children lay around him, caught in the same awful grip as he. He couldn't tell if they were alive. Even if he could have turned his head to the side, he couldn't have seen them. The light spearing in from the doorway didn't reach into the corners where they lay huddled. There had never been a sickness like this before. Not in anyone's memory. A sickness that struck so many simultaneously, like a lightning bolt, with blinding headaches, high fever, bone-breaking pain, and vomiting. A sickness that had dropped people squarely in their tracks. In less than 2 days, the social fabric of the island had come unraveled. Bodies lay unburied, not only inside the vill's squalid huts, but in the winding narrow lanes and along the Gulf shore. The how of it was an unsolvable mystery. Any one of the island's recent visitors could have brought the terrible sickness with them. The traders had all sailed away before the outbreak. The fire talker had fallen ill, along with everyone else. Deep in his chest, Oki felt a stabbing, tearing, transecting pain. Then, hot blood gushed from his lungs into his throat, filling it. Gore sprayed over his chest and drooled down the sides of his face and neck. His throat refilled at once as the massive hemorrhaging continued. There was no end to it. Buckets of his own blood choked him. As Oki's consciousness faded, long, powerful arms lifted him from the sodden pallet. To his horror, he was not carried up through the roof into the bright and open sky, but down through the floor, into smothering blackness. Into the pit. Daniel DeCipio strolled around the perimeter of the vacated vill, his survivalist do-rag tied over his nose and mouth in a futile attempt to filter out the stench of death. There was no longer any need to pretend he was one of the stricken. He was the only person moving. Everyone else was either deceased or on the verge of same, or otherwise incapacitated. He guessed at least 100 people, fully half the island's population, were down and out, without his lifting so much as a finger. The more things changed, the more they stayed the same. Body count was still a central focus in his life. Unlike Typhoid Mary, his early 20th century predecessor, Daniel didn't deny that he was the source of the plague. What he did deny was that it was his responsibility. After all, he hadn't asked to be turned into a living bioweapon. It was something that had been done to him. He saw himself as the quintessential victim. If he had had any sympathy for those he infected, he might have summoned the courage to take his own life. Absent sympathy, he felt only hate for his victims. He loathed them for their weakness, blamed them for their susceptibility to the flavivirus, and saw them as the root cause of his predicament. After all, if nobody got sick from the disease he carried, if it hadn't made people die like flies, he'd have been a free man. To his left, a shallow pit had been opened in the beach sand, and bloated corpses tumbled in, their limbs tangled together. He pulled the camouflage do-rag tighter over his face. Shovels lay discarded at the verge of the hole. Panic had set in, as it always did when disease swept through like a firestorm. The still healthy had abandoned the dead and the sick, taking shelter in the freighter, as if that could protect them. Part of Daniel, the needy, greedy core of who he was, reveled in the avalanche of destruction he had wrought. He dimly remembered sitting on a summer sidewalk in shorts as a small boy, squishing a column of ants one by one with his little pink thumb, and making up a story about himself as a terrible god teaching lessons of fear and obeisance to the helpless and insignificant. The meat of his 29 published books, which were also power fantasies, had come to life. He had become a force of nature, albeit uncontrollable. A 4-year-old with bigger thumbs. Although that small hidden part of him rejoiced as he took in the carnage, Daniel felt a growing sense of unease, of emptiness, even despair. Not because of the indiscriminate loss of innocent life, but by what the looming one-sided victory presaged: reconfinement. Daniel's liberty, such as it was about to come to an end. He had at most a few hours of freedom left. Like a trained bird of prey, again and again his masters released him to perform a single murderous trick. Then, when the trick was done, he was reeled back and returned to his cage. Literally. What he bore in his blood was far too dangerous for there to be any option but solitary imprisonment. Why didn't he seize the opportunity to get away while he still had the chance? Why didn't he push a boat off the beach and head for the mainland as fast as he could row? What held him shackled when his overseers were miles away? Daniel DeCipio was not a hunter. He was not even a gatherer. He was a talker. Even in his pre-dark profession, he'd been a squawking parrot in a flock of same. He lacked the physical skills and training, and the inclination to exist as a solo predator. And he couldn't function as a social animal in close contact and cooperation with others of his kind. It was guaranteed that if he removed himself to some backwater ville, close to half the residents would be dead within a week's time. Those who recovered from the first round of illness would be taken in the second round, after they were reinfected by mosquitoes. If he revealed his predicament in advance to those offering him hospitality, he could expect to be killed on the spot and his body burned to ashes. There was no way around it. The evil seed that lurked in his blood chained him invisibly to the jailers who fed, clothed, and protected him. The other reason he could not summon the will to flee was fear. Fear of what would happen to him if he was caught running away. Daniel circled wide around the anti-personnel mined paths and headed across the littered dunes for the northwest tip of the island. He had watched the claymores being positioned and armed, amused by the islanders' defense plan. There was no reason for the Matachin to enter the ville proper before assaulting the freighter. The dying couldn't be saved. There was no treatment for the genetically engineered plague. Islanders in the ship with natural resistance to the virus, those who only came down with flu-like symptoms, or the few who showed no signs of infection, would be pacified and then taken as part of the spoils, as slaves. With the ville and its reek well behind him, he moved the do-rag from over his nose and mouth and retied it around his head. As he walked, he sucked down the salt air blowing off the gulf, felt the humid breeze on his face, the sun on his back, and heard the waves lapping against the shore. Daniel tried to soak it all in, to hold the experience, but he knew that every step took him closer to the door of his cage. His lower lip began to quiver, and his eyes brimmed with tears. The heavy machine gun position on the southwest point of the island was manned, but only technically. The two gunners inside the bunker were slumped against the sandbags and steel plate, dead. There was no one to stop him, no one to challenge him. Daniel walked to the tip of the point, to the edge of the water, and took a signal flare from his vest. He pulled the striker tab and held the tube over his head. The exploded rocket flashed fluorescent pink and billowing pink smoke. He tossed the spent tube aside, squinting at the horizon line. The pirate fleet waited just beyond the curve of the Earth, watching for his signal. As terrible as they were, the Matachin were only the instruments, the familiars of something infinitely worse. As was he. More than a century ago, Daniel recalled reading some obscure scientist's theory about the nature of thought, which put forward the proposition that ideas operate like viruses, with no reproductive machinery of their own, spreading from brain to brain, mutating over the course of transmission. Like viruses, some ideas were harmless, others were anything but. The idea that now stalked the Earth was an ancient legend. It had had 1,500 years, and the assistance of Armageddon, to evolve and flower. Unlike Slaughter Realms, it was not cobbled together by a committee of English lit majors from bits and pieces of cross-cultural fables, a slapdash reassembly that diluted and eviscerated the underlying power. This legend was pure. It was complete. Much of what had passed for entertainment in pre-dark popular culture was a pale imitation or parody of the basic concept, that the world was a shambles, the playground of insane demons. This twisted world was neither imitation nor parody. Daniel had seen the truth of it with his own two eyes. An abrupt change in the pitch and roll of the ship woke Mildred, and she couldn't fall back to sleep. She lay beside JB in one of the bow's V-berths, hanging on as Tempest pounded through rising waves. Outside, a torrential rain was falling. There was so much water vapor in the air, it was hard to breathe.
What's the matter?
Sorry. I didn't mean to wake you up.
JB lifted his head slightly and squinted at her in the darkness.
Rain bothering you?
Sort of.
It's just what?
I feel changed. I don't feel right about the argument we all had earlier, but JB, it made me start thinking. Thinking about things I've tried to forget.
Like what?
What my life used to be like. What I did. Who I knew. Who I was. My work. My friends. The whole world full of people doing their own thing, but somehow making it work for us all. Big things. Little things like flush toilets, electricity, refrigeration, a hot bath whenever I wanted one. Oh, God. And the sheer amount of information. Books, movies, music, internet. Since I woke up, nothing is like that. There is no science, no real medicine, no search for knowledge. There's only the gun, and using it to stay alive.
Not good to think back, Mildred. You drive yourself crazy if you do. I thought we could move on. What made you think of this now, after everything we've been through?
Well, what Tom said earlier, it hit me like a shot between the eyes, made me think of things I've been too busy surviving to really focus on. The current level of culture, savage though it is propped up by artifacts from the highest point of human industry and civilization. If anybody in the hellscape had figured out how to build things again, we'd have heard by now. To create those skills in the first place, society has to get to a certain level. The devolution of Deathlands has been postponed by the stockpiles and caches of pre-dark goods that have survived the new cost. This means the Deathlands haven't hit bottom yet. Based on everything we've seen and done so far, I think rock bottom is going to be triple ugly.
So what does that mean? Leaving the Deathlands? For what? And where? And what about us?
Mildred turned and pressed closer to JB, wrapping her arm around his waist. After a moment, he curved his arm around her shoulders, but she could feel him still looking at her, waiting.
You, all of you, saved my life. We've been through hell together. Your family. Please don't pull away from me, JB. We've got time to follow Ryan's plan. We don't have to decide anything yet about where we'll be more than a month from now. One thing I have learned, planning that far ahead nowadays is asking for trouble.
True. It's just, I don't want to lose you. Especially to something that may not even exist.
Shh. Listen. The rain's calming down. Let's go back to sleep. We have a long day tomorrow.
With the slackening of the rain, Mildred's eyes drifted closed, and she slept once more. By morning, the sun was out from behind the clouds, blazing hot through the portholes on either side of the bow. Mildred carefully rolled out of the berth so as not to wake JB. Then, timing her gait with the roll and heave of the boat, she climbed the forward companionway steps to the foredeck. The wind whipping off the gulf cooled her down at once. The flying spray was as warm as bathwater. On the landward side, the sea was stained the color of rust, and yellow custard foam topped the waves. The wind carried the smell of baking bread. Mildred realized that it was the odor from volatile petrochemicals still seeping into the gulf from ruptured tanks inland. Iridescent toxins, oils, and tars had streaked Tempest's white deck and combing a nasty yellow brown. She looked back toward the stern and saw the captain and Ryan standing in the cockpit talking, but she couldn't hear them over the wind and surf. Mildred moved aft, holding onto the stays and starboard rail, and climbed down into the cockpit. Tom nodded to her.
Rough as a cob for a while there. Sorry, but I couldn't run around it. Too big a squall, and it was coming too fast.
No problem.
She glanced up at the stern rail. The rail-mounted machine gun was still shrouded in its waxed canvas.
I take it we're still clear of pursuit?
Lucked out so far.
Competition is probably laying further offshore to stay out of the weather.
The two seemed to get along well, Mildred noted. That wasn't surprising. Both were products of the hellscape, and they were in many ways similar. Stoic, determined, battle-seasoned, fearless. Men of legendary prowess who didn't give a good goddamn what folks said or thought of them. It had already occurred to Mildred that Ryan might be more intrigued by the voyage of exploration than the other three Deathlanders. After all, he had been trawled to the Shadow World, a parallel Earth that had missed the new cost and was by far the worse for it. That experience had forcibly opened his mind to other possibilities, to alternatives to the status quo. Though he was a leader, Ryan was also very much his own person, a craggy promontory in the hellstorm. It seemed that Harmonica Tom had touched a nerve. Ryan was taking his offer seriously, unlike the others. Mildred knew that their hunker-down mentality could have been the product of exhaustion. All of them had expended strenuous effort in the preceding 24 hours, running and fighting while dehydrated and half-starved. If it was a temporary stubbornness, only time, rest, and more food would tell. Tempest soon left the rusty sea behind. The edge of the discolored water was a stark borderline where suspended rust turned to deep emerald green. Beyond it, the gulf swell became widely spaced and even. They were making excellent time, with a steady wind and clear sailing ahead. Tom rubbed his eyes with the back of his hand, and Mildred finally noticed how bloodshot they were.
I'm nuked. Gotta shut my eyes for a little while. Carter, can you handle the ship and hold course while I have a snooze?
Sure.
Keep the wind at your back. Don't run into anything big.
Just after noon, with Tom back in command, they approached the eastern tip of what had once been North Padre Island. Stretching ahead of them to the southwest, as far as the eye could see, was a vast curve of intermittently breaking surf. Small waves crashed on a patchy, seemingly endless offshore shoal. Like an abandoned spider web, hummocks of barely submerged sand caught ships. They were derelicts as old as Skydark, cadaverous tankers, freighters, and shrimpers. Some of the wreckage was smaller, made of fiberglass, and far more recent. The shoal was still catching traitors' ships. There were no lighthouses, no warning buoys marking the shallow water. The capsized, rusted-out hulks were a testament to the limits of dead reckoning.
Look alive, folks. Another 20 miles to the Ville. 2 hours, maybe, and we'll be there.
Jack beelined for the bowsprit, and there he sat, his ghostly face into the breeze, his long white hair flying behind his head. Doc and Christy joined Ryan and Tom in the cockpit. JB was the last to make it up there. He climbed the steep steps slowly, like an old man. His ribs had really stiffened up during the night. He winced as he took a seat on the padded bench beside Mildred, cradling his chest with a forearm.
Want me to rewrap your ribs? Has the bandage come loose?
No. It's okay. The ship rolled and I caught myself wrong. I'll be fine in a minute.
With that, he tipped his fedora down over his eyes, settled into the seat cushion, and seemed to go back to sleep. He didn't want to discuss his pain, which from experience, Mildred guessed meant he was hurting plenty. There was nothing she could do about that. She couldn't even offer him an aspirin. Barring compound fracture and lung punctures, rib injuries were customarily left to heal on their own. JB was going to be hurting for a good long while. 6 miles away, on the far side of the shoal, was the mainland coast, the southernmost edge of the much-feared Dallas-Houston death zone. What Mildred saw was a dark green wall of mangrove branches and the sun gleaming off trapped backwaters. Above the treetops, skeletal structures protruded, some of them clearly industrial, with cylindrical four-story tall holding tanks and latticework walkways. Others looked like condo towers, gutted down to poured concrete walls and floors. Everything was draped with verdurous creepers. Mosses and vines trailed down to the waterline. At the base of the trees, where the beach should have been, lay an unbroken, miles-long pile of rubbish. The partially submerged junk had been backwashed off the land as successive tidal waves receded. A peek through binocs revealed cars and trucks filigreed with rust, disintegrating sofas and mattresses, battered refrigerators, washers, and dryers. On top of it lay the lighter stuff, heaps of splintered wood, plastic, and aluminum. Deeper in the mangrove swamp, dense black smoke boiled up through the canopy and blew inland. There were no visible flames, just smoke. A huge section of the backwater burned. Something floating on the water had caught fire. Oil or gasoline, Mildred thought. Perhaps set off by a lightning strike. Tom leaned over the port rail, scanning the horizon head, while keeping one hand on the wheel to maintain course, a quarter mile from the edge of the breaking surf. Ryan looked out where he was looking, then back at Tom.
What are you looking for?
Looking for the Yoko Maru's radar mast. We'll be able to see the top of the mast long before we catch sight of the island. Gotta be 400 feet off the ground.
From his perch in the bowsprit, Jack leaned forward and pointed.
Looky over there!
It wasn't a mast. Tom cut the wheel hard over to starboard, giving everyone a full-on view of a brilliant pink light low in the sky, slowly sinking out of sight over the curve of the earth.
Signal flare.
From a ship?
Probably.
How far off?
Hard to tell. A ways.
May we assume that some unfortunates ran their vessel aground?
Could be. Take the helm, Ryan.
Harmonica Tom pulled the waxed shroud off the stern-mounted gun and tossed it into the cockpit. The Soviet-made PKM light machine gun sported an unfluted barrel and a skeletonized rear plastic stock and pistol grip. It had no carrying handle atop the action. Instead of a bipod, it pivoted 180 degrees on a stand clamped to the rail. Under the receiver, like a gigantic olive-drab sardine can on its side, a 100-round belt boxed mag rode horizontally. The action and barrel glistened with protective grease. The business end of the ammo belt was already in the feedway. After removing and pocketing the muzzle plug, Tom dropped the selector switch from safety to fire, then charged the cocking handle.
Would traitors turn pirate use an emergency SOS flare to lure another ship in close?
Yeah. Maybe a couple of you should go below and stock up on ammo for everybody. There's a hatch under the rubber mat in the forward cabin. Pull out the big plastic tubs. It's all boxed and clearly marked, caliber and load. You should find everything you need.
Jack and Doc went below to gather up the requisite ammo, as well as to fetch JB's shotgun and Ryan's scope rifle. Everyone else watched the horizon for the ship that had sent up the flare. Minutes passed. Jack and Doc returned with the bullets. They all reloaded their weapons and their extra mags.
Anybody see anything?
Nothing but empty sea, so far.
Tom lifted his binoculars and looked ahead.
Well, there's Padre Island. Here, see for yourselves.
He passed the optics to Ryan. After Ryan looked, he passed it on to JB. When it was Mildred's turn to look, she aimed the lenses at the dark blip on the horizon to seaward, along the curve of shoal that divided the intracoastal waterway from the gulf. She saw the top of the grounded ship's radar mast and the tattered, enormous Lone Star flag flapping against the bright blue sky.
All right. Mind the boom, folks. We're changing course.
Turning toward the shore, Tom ran the vessel through Aransas Pass, which at once separated Mustang Island and San Jose Island. Both land masses were gone now, but the deep water channel between them still remained. Tempest entered the intracoastal waterway and continued southwest, pushed by a steady breeze. As they steadily bore down on their target, more and more masts became visible. The top third of the freighter's towering rear smokestack was missing. The white bridge and wheelhouse atop the aft superstructure appeared. Then, gradually, the whole ship came into view. It looked as if a giant hand had carefully lifted, then set the freighter down on dry land. It rested on its keel, slightly canted to port, on the highest point of the island. The top deck was still stacked three high in places with cargo containers. Some had tumbled over the side and onto the sand. Ryan glanced at Tom.
How long since you've been here?
Almost 2 months. After I arranged for the scroungers to get to C4, I sailed away east. I've been all the way to the Lenas and back since then. I had a shipload of Islander goods to move. Shoes, clothes, ammo. You're not gonna believe the pre-dark stuff they've got in that freighter.
Your ship's pretty much empty, though. You traded the Islander goods for what?
Small objects of big value to barons. Easily concealed items. Gold and silver rings, bracelets, teeth.
So what was the SOS flare all about? Is the ship that fired it farther to the south? Is that why we haven't come across it? Or did it sink without a trace before we reached it?
Neither of those things is likely. If the ship had been farther away over the horizon, we wouldn't have seen the flare. If the ship had run aground on one of the sandbars, it would still be stuck there. I think the signal came from the island. The distance is about right. There's probably nothing. Just some of the kids playing around. The place is crawling with them. Islanders take their breeding serious.
As they scooted along the outer edge of Corpus Christi Bay, Mildred glanced over at the ruins of Corpus itself. Aside from the skeletal skyline, there wasn't much to see. The city was derelict, flooded, abandoned, and overgrown. At the northeast corner of Padre Island, on the edge of a low bluff, was a partially buried gun position. The bunker was roofed and reinforced with layers of corrugated steel hacked from cargo containers. It was also heavily sandbagged. The firing port was a dark slit that ran the width of the emplacement. Mildred could make out the muzzle and ramp front sight of a heavy machine gun just inside the opening. No faces popped up as they glided by, and the MG sights didn't turn and track them. If there were guns on the freighter, she couldn't see them. The up angle to the top deck was too steep. She could see through the underside of the radar mast's steel mesh platform. The flag was flying, but nobody was watching the store. Ahead was the ruin of the JFK Causeway Bridge, which had connected Padre to the mainland. Only the footings on either side of the bridge remained intact. The deck had fallen into the channel. Tom steered Tempest to the deepest part of the waterway and slipped between the jutting stubs of the bridge pilings. The ship began to lose way as it swung into the island's lee. The captain cut in close to the shore, taking the shortest route to the protected anchorage. The beach was deserted. There were no other ships in the bay.
Where is everybody?
Is something wrong?
No, ships come and go all the time. Sometimes the bay is packed, sometimes it's empty.
What about the people? You said there were lots of kids.
Actually, I don't know. It's weird that there's no cook smoke rising from the Ville.
The rusting bow of the Yokomaru loomed above the Ville's clustered shacks, cresting an immense wave of sand. Mildred could imagine, the next instant, the Lilliputian hovels squashed flat under its weight. There were maybe 100 ramshackle dwellings, built along the slope that led down to the anchorage, separated by winding narrow lanes. It was hardly an impressive trading center, even by Deathland's minimal standards. The residential shacks were not much bigger than the outhouses. And there was debris everywhere, paper, metal, and plastic.
So the islanders are all in the freighter?
There's no place else for them to be. Maybe they're taking inventory. And maybe they're counting their kids. They ain't all run off, that's for sure. Wouldn't leave their pot of gold.
Tom dropped his sails and coasted into the middle of the anchorage. As the ship rapidly lost speed, he hopped out of the cockpit and ran forward to lower the anchor. Momentum carried the ship forward. Tom continued paying out more chain until he had the proper scope. Then he locked it off with an eyebolt. As Tempest swung around at anchor, the captain stared at the deserted beach, hands on his hips. Without a word, he walked back to the cockpit and furiously yanked on the rope attached to the ship's bell. Nothing stirred on the land. Tom scowled.
That should have brought out the camp dogs. There's not a rat blasted one of them. Something is seriously wrong. I can feel it.
Perhaps, dear friends, we should rethink our plan of action. Perhaps our going ashore this afternoon isn't such a good idea after all. Perhaps a better course would be for us to move on while we can. Surely the East Coast Barons will pay well enough for the explosive.
We're already here. Least we can do is check it out. If it doesn't look right, we'll make tracks in a hurry. Let's leave the C-4 below decks for now. It'll just slow down the wreck. We can come back for it if everything's okay.
Help me get the big raft in the water.
Ryan and Jack walked to the 12-foot gantry holding the suspended raft and put their shoulders to it, while Tom manned the pulley rope switch.
Easy does it. Easy. And there we go. That's big enough for everyone, but JB, maybe you'd better stay behind. You're gonna have a hell of a time getting in and out of the dinghy.
I'm fine.
You might be able to carry that scatter gun, but shooting it is going to cause you a world of hurt. No reason for you to take the chance of injuring yourself anymore.
I'll be just fine.
Suit yourself.
Everyone get your gear, and let's get going.
Ryan and Tom helped the others down into the boat, then they climbed in themselves. Seven people made the dinghy mighty cramped, but the distance to the island was short, no more than 75 yards. When everybody was seated and as comfortable as they were going to get, Tom put out the oars and, leaning his back into it, began rowing them to shore. Ryan sat on the bow, his rifle at the ready, scope lens uncapped, just in case. As the inflatable raft skidded up onto the beach, a smell enveloped them. Rank, putrid, eye-watering, unmistakable.
Oh, God.
Fucking shit. That ain't home cooking.
Daniel DeCipio shielded his eyes from the sun with the flat of his hand, searching the horizon to the southwest for a sign of the oncoming Matachin mini-armada. The pirate ships first appeared as a row of dark dots in the seam between sea and sky, then vanished one by one as they slipped into the trough of the offshore swell, reappearing again as they climbed the crest, disappearing and reappearing. As the vessels crept closer and closer to the island, with his naked eye, Daniel could distinguish the three low squat shapes of their ocean-going tugs. No plumes of dark brown smoke pumped up from their stacks. To save precious fuel, the tugs were under people power until they closed on the target. There were plenty of able-bodied rowers to choose from, former residents of Browns and Matamorosvilles, conscripted into service at gun and blade point. The Matachin had all the time in the world to reach their destination. Their quarry wasn't going anywhere, and for damn sure, reinforcements weren't on the way. Sweeping in front of the trio of tugs, four sailing ships beat back and forth to make headway against the breeze. They were the fleet's pursuit and interdiction craft. The pre-dark tugs carried more than enough ordnance to dismantle Padre's stationary defenses. They carried enough HE to flatten the place end to end. And the master of the fleet was no stranger to excess. Under the command of machete-wielding commander Guillermo Casacampo, the venerable nautical catchphrase, "all hands on deck," took on a grisly literal meaning. Post-conquest, the hands of the defeated lay severed and scattered along the scuppers of his flagship, while their former owners bobbed like corks in the armada's wake, waving bloody stumps and attracting muty sharks in droves. When the ships came within 10 miles of the island, they started to spread out to their assigned attack positions. Although there were no sounds of alarm from the Yokomaru, the surviving islanders had to be able to see what was coming. They had to be getting nervous. Daniel was starting to get nervous too. This part of the operation always gave him butterflies. He had seen things go sour before. Matachin cannon crews in a chill frenzy tended to lose focus and get swept up in the moment. The really big worry, however, was Casacampo himself. His ships can only carry and feed so many slaves, and stow only so much booty. They already had gathered more than enough of both from the previous two sackings. Under the circumstances, the commander was free to take even wider liberties with human lives, including Daniel's. After all, he wasn't the only plague vector at their disposal. Disposal being the operative word. He hurried away from the shore. It was time to relocate to a nice, safe place. The job of disease vector was no cakewalk. Accidents happened in the heat of battle. Shrapnel was indiscriminate, as was automatic weapon fire. Sometimes dengue fever carriers infiltrating a new ville were murdered just because they were strangers, or for some other reason unrelated to the threat they posed. Not all of them were fire talkers. Some were whores, some were traitors, some were mercies. Or combinations of same. The key was sociability, making new friends. Daniel climbed to the top of the dunes and jogged along the ridge to make better time. He had already scoped out the best spot, in the center of the island, as far as possible from the machine gun emplacements, the ville, and the grounded freighter, the main targets of the Matachin gunners. While the folks abandoned in the ville struggled in their death throes, he had dug himself a deep, narrow foxhole in the sand. At times like these, the Freezy saw himself as Faust, selling his soul not once, but to a succession of ever more fiendish devils. The first mortgage was given to the publisher of Slaughter Realms in return for the warm glow of seeing his very own words in print. Then it was to the mercy of scientists by answering an ad in the back of an alternative throwaway newspaper for medical research subjects, some foreign travel required, top pay, and stock options. The initial interview and physical exam had gone well. He'd been offered the job of human lab rat, which promised close to 10 times his current annual salary. The details of the research program were skimmed over with platitudes about saving humanity, ending suffering, and promises of virtually no personal risk. All Daniel could see were the dollar signs and the opportunity to uncover something exciting to write about, something worthy of his talent and devotion, something that would bring him the acclaim and reward he deserved. It seemed like a win-win. The moment he arrived at the remote Panamanian research site, a former maximum security prison in the heart of an immense rainforested island, he realized he'd made a frying pan into the fire mistake. As it turned out, the ultra-secret Project Persephone was black box military. Not only was it underfunded and undersupervised, the grave dangers to participants had been purposefully concealed. Once boots were on the ground, there was no way to back out of the deal either. In the first 6 months of captivity, close to 90% of his fellow volunteer test subjects had died from the biological weapon experiments. That Daniel had survived the agonies of infection was a double-edged sword. The experience had turned him into a carrier of weaponized hemorrhagic dengue flavivirus. He couldn't return to civilization without spreading the bioengineered plague. He was stuck in the stinking, sweltering jungle. So much for spending all the money he'd been promised. So much for dreams of using the experience to become a best-selling writer. Eventually, the Project Persephone scientists had convinced him that his only hope was cryogenesis. At some point in the future, a cure would be found, and he'd be free to rejoin humanity. A little more than a century later, thawed out in a time that still offered no cure, he had signed the third Faustian Pact, this one with the worst of the lot, the Lords of Death, also known as the Shibaldum. The other options on the table were death by torture and suicide. Atapul X, the highest ranking of the Lords of Death, made Commander Casacampo look like Mother Teresa. He was living proof that evil, along with eye and hair color, resided in the genes. Daniel remembered Atapul X's distant ancestor most vividly. When he had first arrived at the decaying compound's helipad, Atapul Suarez Denisac had been one of the prisoners held over from the Noriega days, still incarcerated because he was too dangerous to transport. The last surviving inmates of Panama's Devil's Island were glue and gasoline sniffing, brain-damaged mass murderers and rapists. They'd been sold as a job lot to the Project Persephone scientists, part of the shabby furnishings of the molded concrete prison, to do with whatever they pleased. While Daniel was enduring the scientists' experimentation, Suarez Denisac, a homicidal maniac with delusions of grandeur, had led a violent prisoner escape into the bush. Living in dense forest among the crocodiles, bushmasters, vampire bats, and packs of feral dogs, the escapees had turned cannibal, waylaying and devouring the military police who tried to track them down. By the time the ringleader was recaptured by prison authorities, Daniel was already in cryostasis, locked away in the bowels of the main structure. As the legend went, Suarez Denisac had renamed himself Atapul I after Armageddon and the fall of the White Coat compound. By an unhappy and tragic twist of fate, the psychotic delusions of Suarez Denisac turned out to be pretty much on the money, as 5 generations of subsequent history would attest. Daniel was about to jump down into the hidey hole he'd prepared when out of the corner of his eye he caught a blur of movement. He turned, and through the long strands of dune grass, saw the top of a 3-masted ship, sails furled, as it glided to a stop in the otherwise deserted anchorage. A sea-going trader, arriving late to the party, and the skipper and crew couldn't see what was bearing down on the other side of the island. The unlucky fucks were about to get the surprise of their lives. The companions fanned out on the empty beach with weapons drawn. Nothing moved along the shore. Nothing moved upslope from the direction of the huts, either. Mildred and the others advanced on Ryan's signal, with a long, low berm of recently turned sand about 75 feet above the waterline. The odor of death was coming from that direction, as was the droning of flies. Neither boded well. four shovels lay discarded on the burn. Covering her nose and mouth with a hand, Mildred looked over the verge of the excavated pit. The open grave was 5 feet deep and about 8 feet across. It held corpses of all ages, men, women, children, babies, piled on top of each other in a tangle, all with bloodied faces and clothes. Some of the dead were horribly bloated. Mildred saw scurrying movement in the pit, black shadows, long-tailed blurs scattering, darting among the bodies. Rats. Christy's green eyes stared over the top of her cupped hand. The prehensile tendrils of her red, muddy hair had drawn up into tight ringlets of alarm.
There's got to be more than 30 people in there.
Massacred.
Mildred watched the captain's face as he took in the victims. The youthful light went out of his eyes for a second. It just winked out. He looked suddenly as old as the creases in his face.
What the hell happened?
It doesn't appear they were gunshot.
And what killed them?
Only one way to find out.
Carefully, Mildred got to her knees by the pit's edge and leaned forward.
There's petechia on exposed skin pretty much everywhere. Those red spots there. My specialty was with biochemistry and cryogenic resuscitation. My med school days are more than 100 years ago. This could be any number of things. Some kind of influenza, bird flu. It could also be a mass poisoning from a red tide. Cigarettera, or a pre-dark chemical that somehow ended up in their water or food supply. There's no way to tell for sure without drawing blood and tissue samples from the deceased and putting them through a toxicology lab. And we all know that ain't gonna happen.
How long have they been dead?
In this heat, your guess is as good as mine. 10 hours? 5 hours?
Why did the grave diggers not complete the interment? Why did they not cover the bodies?
Maybe they took sick too.
Could they all be chilled? Could the whole ville be wiped out?
Perhaps we should take this for a sign. A biblical visitation of plague is by definition random and puts wayfarers such as ourselves at grave risk. I hasten to remind everyone that the ship awaits.
They not all croaked.
There were a couple hundred people living here. I did a lot of business with them. I liked them. Some were my friends. If anyone's still alive on the island and can be saved, we need to find out and get them out of here. Maybe they can tell us what happened. You can wait here or go back to the Tempest if you want, but I'm going ahead.
I'll come along.
We'll all come along.